Well, I came over the bridge, and it was an incredibly blustery, windy day over there. I don't know if it was as windy over here. But it felt in the room like, you know, when there's wind, there's all this agitation and circulation and unsettled quality. And it felt like it had permeated the room. It took a little time for everything to organize itself into just being here, being present. And as I was reflecting on that, I was reflecting on myself and my own hesitation in just being where I find myself in the moment. You know, I was already trying to have an influence on what my immediate moment-to-moment experience was. I couldn't just settle into what was true. I was strategizing. And it occurred to me that this practice lands us right in the middle of our own discomfort. And that's the challenge of it, and that's why it's called hard work. People look at us from the outside and they think, wow, here we are just sitting, doing nothing, being quiet. What's the big deal? But it's a huge deal. It takes a lot of dedication and intention to stay with the discomforts and the agitations that accumulate over a day, over a week, over a year, over a lifetime, and show up from the very first moment that we commit to being still and being quiet. I remember my first 10-day retreat way back when. Very wonderful teacher from Thailand noticed that every now and then in the group, somebody would have their eyes open and look around at other people. You know, we've all done that. And one of his comments was, what is so interesting about watching people try to work at being present with themselves? So, you know, the usual answer is, well, it's a distraction from one's own discomfort. But, you know, the word distraction comes up so often in practice. And what is distraction and why do we criticize it? Really, it's paying attention and then adding judgment. Like, this is not worthy of our attention. Wherever our attention might go, it's supposed to stay with the sensation of breathing. And when it leaves, you bring it back. But then there comes a time when attention does its own thing. It finds its own object, independent of what we want it to do. A lot of times, when we first sit, there's an incredible restlessness and a reluctance to really commit and really beginning to think, how am I going to do this 40 minutes, 35, 40 minutes today? And then we are also infused with the desire to have certain experiences, magical experiences, you know, transcending experiences, those golden moments when we really just settle. And there's this glow of peacefulness in the present moment. We want that. We don't get it all the time. And even when we get it, it slips away. And then the agitation comes back in, you know. And we try to make sense out of our agitation. Oh, this means this and that, and this means that I am, and this means that I'm not doing something right. And all the significance that we try to associate with our moment-to-moment experience, which is just a projection. It's not necessarily the truth. But our mind wants to help us find solutions. And it never stops in that attempt, especially when we're uncomfortable. So maybe the thing is to just notice the discomfort of having nothing to do but just be present with oneself. There's a wonderful quote by Tim Ferriss that I discovered a couple of months ago, and I put it all over my notebooks and things at home. And he says, time is a non-renewable resource. So every moment that we're not attending and awake to that moment, we're throwing out. Every moment that we want to get ahead of ourselves, let's get over this discomfort. Let's see what we can do to resolve this issue. Let's see what we can strategize to become more comfortable. We're always leaving the truth of what we find in that moment. And when we leave the truth of the moment, we're tossing a moment of time away as if it doesn't count for anything. So when I reflect on myself, how much of my lifetime so far have I just tossed out by not being awake, not being conscious, wanting some different experience than what was true in that moment, in that breath? Some people feel that the origin of that kind of pressure to get beyond and to pull through is started with the Big Bang, you know? And that karmically, we're all still resonating with the huge explosion that created this universe that is always forward moving, that is so overwhelmingly powerful. And that we're all resonating, undulating with the waves of that force. And that might be true, but even that is something that we can rest in and experience in the truth of the moment, of that undulation, of that pushing forward, of that restlessness of the, in the Buddhist terms, is called the power of becoming as opposed to being. So time is a non-renewable resource. Let's not waste it. Even right now, listening to me, sitting as we're sitting, moving our bodies when we need to, we're not, it's all okay. We're a little bit divorced from the body and the depth of attention that we have when we practice, because you're paying attention to me. You're paying attention to what I'm saying, instead of paying attention to what's going on at this very moment for yourselves, in this very moment, in this very room, with each other, here and now. I've had friends who don't meditate ask me, doesn't it get boring? You know, and sometimes it is a little boring. It's a little dead, you know. There's nothing going on, just breathing and the body. And the mind has a tendency to get quiet. It ceased trying to entertain us with worry and stories and adventures and fantasies and imagination and all the factors of getting away from the truth of the moment. But the simple act of just being present can sometimes feel like we're approaching the shore of that ocean we call emptiness. And when we consider the possibility of true emptiness, it gets a little scary. And sometimes I feel when people use the word boring, what they're alluding to is the possibility that for just a few moments, nothing dramatic is happening. There's just sitting and nothing else. And fundamentally, that's the core of being. That's the core of this existence. We're bodies, we're breathing, we're in the state that we call alive at this moment. And somehow, unless we have some drama, it's not enough. You're nodding a lot, so I'm talking at least to your experience. That's good to know. Yeah. So, speaking of talking to your experience, I would love to converse with this group rather than me giving the talk, giving the lecture, you know, giving the pearls of wisdom. I would love to have a group conversation where there's more sharing, more less formality, less self-consciousness, if it's possible in a meditation group. Yeah. You take the mic. Okay, and the mic will go around and I will talk louder. But you know, it's good to just kind of what Howie calls Dharma down. Let's Dharma down. Let's get real. Let's talk. What's happening? What can we address tonight and solve once and for all?
Hello. May I ask a question about my sit? It was great. I had this experience where I started thinking of our family dog, and maybe it's because Toshi's here, but it was this very profound, joyful way I was thinking about, his name's Ollie, and Oliver. Yeah, I know. But I was just beaming and I was smiling and it was just like very profound. I thought I was just going to start laughing out loud. So I was like, don't do that. But then I've training with meditation. I always have this come back to my anchor, like let the thoughts pass. And that was coming over while I was having this very emotional, like heartfelt moment. I was just wondering if like during your practice, because usually it's stress or anxiety for me that it like crosses my mind. In that case, I try to step back and acknowledge it and let it pass over. But I was wondering if you should be in it and embrace that moment, if it's very positive or like very emotionally positive and uplifting. Does that make sense?
That's a good general question. I think we all wonder, you know, when do we hold on to the feeling? Do we have another mic?
Yeah,
it doesn't work, unfortunately. No. Yeah, but so, you know, hey, we'll just have to project. So, the question is, when we have certain experiences, which experiences do we want to hold on to? And which experiences do we want to wait and see if they can just leave? You know, step back and wait and see while the surface of the ocean settles down. I, myself, personally, have a lot of feeling for that heartfelt warmth that only an animal can give us, right? Because animals have a kind of a purity of presence and immediacy. And, you know, they don't lie, they don't manipulate. A little bit they manipulate, but not a lot. Hi, you. He's had an operation, so he's just getting back on his feet. So I'm going to help him get up on this thing. Hang on a second. I know, it's like, I don't know what we would do without animals. They humanize us, you know. What you're talking about, that incredible heart glow, feels so good. You know, And it's a very, very tricky thing to be light-fingered about what we do with the content of our moment-to-moment experience. So as we practice more, we can feel our attachment to a certain state, because it feels so good. And we can feel our pushing away another state, anxiety, because it really is uncomfortable. And the object of awareness is the tendency to attach or to push away, not the content. It's closer to the mechanism that is operating, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So we're always trying to get behind the thing that is prominent and notice our attitude towards it. And mainly, you know, when an experience is pleasant, we will hold on to it. And if an experience is unpleasant, we'll do some rigmaroling with it. And so the thing to attend to is our response to the content of our experience, more than our actual experience. Because this is the mechanism that we're attending right now, is our response. Does that make sense? Okay. And you can do no wrong. Yes. I myself, this evening, I had some, you know, I personally don't like wind. I have a preference. And someplace I read, and it sounds a little woo-woo, but it could be true, that especially women's outer energy field gets very distressed when there's turbulence in the air. And I feel that. Either it suggested it to me, and now I feel the truth of it, or whatever. And so when I first sat down here, I was feeling that. And I was uncomfortable, and I thought, oh my God, here I am trying to be the meditation teacher, and I'm all blurred up, and he needs help getting up. You know, there were things that were distressing me about how I would perform tonight, given that I was so ricocheting inside. And then at one point, I don't know what time into the meditation, I realized I want to pay attention to the part of me that has an attitude about what my experience is and not the experience. And that actually helped root me. And the root went deeper, and I actually did find a place where I felt steady. You know, but we can always do that in any situation. I was upset about the election in Israel. You know, there's always stuff to be upset about. Life is very generous with that, especially nowadays. And so what to do to notice the upsetness, but to notice our relationship to being upset is closer to the core. So the Buddha once was, you know, whether he was a real person or it really happened, who knows what, but the story goes, he was talking to a group of monks, and his favorite monk, Ananda, asked him, "Oh, Lord Buddha, is it true that relationship is part of the holy life?" And the Buddha said, "Oh, no, Ananda. Relationship is the whole of the holy life. So everything that we encounter is relationship, meaning it's all engaged with itself. So that's my relationship to myself that I'm talking about. I can be upset about what's going on inside of me, or I can be curious about being upset about what's going on inside of me. The upsetness is the object." Yeah. Yeah. It's a tricky thing. Meditating is a tricky thing. It's always a delicate balance. And there's always a deeper layer that is more related to the immediacy of what is operating inside of us for us to attend to than our emotions. Yeah, or our feelings about things. ultimately, it's a phenomenological examination of the nature of subjective experience as it happens with us being embodied. You know, we're in a very peculiar state right now. And I call it the state of being alive because before we were born and after we die, who knows? Other states, other realities. There's simultaneous universes going on. Science has proven it. So who knows? So in this constantly changing sea, the only thing that we have is orienting towards my relationship moment to moment with my experience. And noticing judgment, of course, and preferences. I'd rather be happy. I'd rather not be uncomfortable, you know. And that, so getting closer to our take on experience rather than identifying with experience. Very important. I think it's a big liberating factor. And you know, our tendencies are habituated. The more we do something, that's how habits are born, through repetition. The more we do that, the more it will just arise automatically. So we're training ourselves. Some people are nodding. It makes sense, huh? Okay. It's tough, I know, because, you know, we're here to be instructed and to be in silence. And anybody else have a question about practice? Yes.
Now it's better, okay. So I was also reading about Israel and I was reading about Bibi being on the beach, making himself a very happy guy because he was going to win for sure, maybe not, hopefully not. But I was thinking, how do I get away from all this horrible world that it's really happening again in my eyes? I mean, I thought like we were never going to see what's happening in the world, and now it's happening. And me as a Mexican Jew, I have from both sides the need to be stronger, to be who I am, never forget who I am, and also be able to accept the world, which I don't accept. And for me, the meditation and the Buddhist part, or call it how we want to call it, it's a good way to see how far I am from myself. I am far away from myself. I'm too much of a thinker. Not a good one, but a thinker.
I know, especially in this group. Eventually it lands into the political situation in the world here, because I know we can't escape it. We can't escape it. But, you know, the way that you describe yourself, you express quite a bit of judgment about how you find yourself from moment to moment. So that's the piece that you want to pay attention to, is that you judge your own experiences. I mean, the world can break one's heart. I'm the daughter of Holocaust survivors from Europe, so I know, you know, watching the world become fascist is a heartbreak. There's nothing that we can do. And I've gradually overcome that horrible feeling of helplessness in the face of it, you know? And there's a natural inclination to be upset. And that's what's arising. It's like the weather, you know, sometimes it's wind, it's not pleasant, but it's a disastrous windstorm, you know? There were fire, you know, we're approaching summer again. There's going to be fires again. There's nothing that we can do. It breaks our hearts. But we have to ride with what is going on and not judge our own take on it. So if you need to weep, weep. If you want to shout, shout. Allow yourself to be influenced and engaged and in relation to everything that's unfolding. We can't not be in relationship to what's unfolding. So the calmness that you want to achieve might not be the natural state of who you are at any given moment. So a lot of, you know, now the word these days is aspirational. People bring a lot of aspiration to their spiritual practice. I want to meditate because I want to be calm, be loving, be generous, be, you know, all those things. But the fact is that we're left with who we are at the moment that we, touch base. And the thing is to drop judgment, you know. Judgment of who we find ourselves to be from moment to moment arises from the training that we have from when we're babies, you know. Their parents, when we cry, they don't want us to cry. When we wet ourselves, they don't want us to, you know, we have to hurry up and change the diaper. There's training in school, and then there's the whole socialization and the conformity of being a part of society, being a part of a family, being a part of a work group. Lots and lots and lots of messages of conformity, which we absorb, and it very much influences our incapacity to just accept ourselves, how we find ourselves in the moment. But that is the root of self-compassion. And whatever state you're in, that's the state you're in. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just the truth of the moment. It might change the next moment or not. But trying to be calm is kind of like, you know, calmness and effortfulness somehow don't fit in the same shoe. You know what I mean? Yeah. Calmness can arise. It is caused by a set of factors that we don't necessarily have control over. When it arises, it feels great. But when you are in a spiritual community, and you're practicing with the intention of arriving at calmness and then staying there, that's aspirational. That's not something that, that means that every state that is not that, you are in judgment of and you're in conflict about. So, you know, I mean, we live in moment-to-moment conflict almost all of the time. Maybe when we're asleep, we don't. We just receive their dreams, whatever they are. But when we wake up, oh my God, what did I do in that dream? You know, it's like we're perpetually in conflict with how we find ourselves from moment to moment. And that causes suffering which is not the suffering that anicca is talking about. It's a suffering of being separate from one's true self in the moment. And that's what you said. You often find yourself away from and distant from yourself. It's because you're not in full acceptance, or as they say, unconditional, radical acceptance. You know, Tara Brach talks about that and writes books about that. And it's a very important message to bring into spiritual practice, because when we enter the spiritual realm, we enter judgment and ideals. This is not my ideal me. This is not my ideal state. So does that make sense? So you can release yourself from some of the judgment that you find when you're not calm? Here, more aspirational. It's hard. It's hard to get away from that. Even being aspirational, it's cool. It means that we have the intention of being better than we are. There's nothing wrong with that, but it creates a subtle conflict. And not that I've been there, but from everything that I've been taught in all the different realms of teaching, it feels like the liberated person is at peace with whatever is true in the moment. And if we need to stand up against fascist cruelty, being in the moment will make us more effective and more powerful than if we sit around worrying about it and wondering. And, you know, there's nothing more powerful than action that arises from the clarity of just being present. It has a very positive effect. Yeah. I like to remind people that the first big practitioners of spiritual practices, especially relating to qi, like Tai Chi and Qigong and all those, were actually military people. That was, you know, they were trying to be in the present moment for the effectiveness of their military duty. So this is not a pacifist practice. Doesn't mean we let the world roll over us. Mahagosananda, who was a wonderful Cambodian teacher that the Dalai Lama loved so much, that when the Dalai Lama was invited to come and give talks in different countries, he would send an airline ticket to Mahagosananda and invite him on stage with him. Mahagosananda called his monks and nuns warriors for truth. And he, in fact, such a sweet, such a lovely, such purity. You know, I've known a lot of teachers, and not many of them are pure. But he was pure. And he was in a monastery training in Thailand when the Pol Pot regime was in Cambodia. And somebody from Cambodia sent a messenger to him saying that his whole family had been killed. And he needed to practice knowing that. So that was a pretty rich practice, I'm sure. But when he went back to Cambodia, he realized that so many Cambodians had gone up to the border of Thailand, and they were residing in something called the UNHCR. So the United Nations set up a retreat for people who were immigrants, who were trying to escape the Pol Pot regime. And so this was a camp for them. And Jack Kornfield was there and took videos of it. And there came a time when Gosananda said, it is time for us to re-inhabit our country. And everybody was terrified, terrified of going back in. And from the border of Thailand, they had to go through a part of Cambodia called Pai Lin, which was still harboring some Khmer Rouge. was determined to help his people repatriate their own country and come home. And they said, how are we going to do this? And he said, you follow me, and I'm going to do it step by step. And it was his strength that they followed him all the way through. And I actually made a documentary film about it, and there's footage. Jack's footage is in there, and footage from this walk. It's what's called the Dhamma Yatra, the walk for peace. But it took a lot of strength, and people had to overcome a lot of fear. Because there were also landmines. I mean, they hadn't been, yeah. So every place that they walked, if they were in a village, people would welcome them who had stayed there, or they would see their family or their friends. They walked from the border of Thailand all the way back to Phnom Penh. So this is not a wussy thing that we're talking about. And it is meant to be strong even in the face of Holocaust or total human disaster. Yeah. There's a wonderful book by a woman named Etty Hillesum, who was in Westerbork. She was a Jew in the Scandinavian countries. And she was put into a camp in Westerbork, which I think is in the Netherlands. And this book is a diary that she kept while she was there. And she was determined to make this experience meaningful in a humane way. And what she explored as she took into account all the people that were so desperate and unhappy and had lost everything and didn't know where their future would be and were really, you know, because there were rumors already that there was, people were being killed. And maybe this was their last stage of life in this camp. And she was surrounded by these people and their desperation and their unhappiness. And she finally came to this insight that would help her get through this experience in a way that she felt was humane. And that was to practice compassion, to attend to people, to listen to them, and to give them basically the mindfulness of just being present, like how he says, just this breath, just this moment, everything is okay right now. Don't move into the future. Don't move into the past. That's the place where the practice really, where the rubber hits the road, you know? She didn't survive. She was killed off at the camp. But it's a great book, Etty Hillesum. And I think it's called An Interrupted Life. She was in her late teens and early 20s through that experience. Yeah. So we have it rather easy, you know. We have enough food, we have shelter, we live in the Bay Area, it's beautiful. I mean, in a way, the practice really comes alive when we really have something that deeply concerns us. And then the practice becomes our ally, you know, because we just can't go with our thoughts to those places. They're just too horrible. But sometimes I feel that we're cultivating this so that when we do have illness, old age, and death, we can do it mindfully and gracefully and not be torn apart. So I never underestimate the power of practice in the face of what's unfolding in the world. Anybody else?
Yeah. beyond being better situated when facing adversity, when those moments arise in your life or in the lives of other avid meditators, is there a noticeable change moment to moment, or in other words, in your everyday life that you can point to beyond those points of extreme adversity in which you're really put to the test?
You know, this guy had to undergo spinal surgery. Well, it is extreme, but so for 4 days he was in UC Davis, and we didn't know what his condition would be, and I couldn't sleep. So I spent 4 nights meditating. But that is an extreme. I mean, that is an extreme thing. But I was very, very happy to have that as something to be able to do, you know, rather than drink or, you know, God knows what, binge watch or I don't know. It was just very, very intense, very intense. But you know, the easiest thing is road rage. That's one of the places to notice. You know, to take a reading of where we're at. If we're very, very reactive to somebody coming in or being too close or taking our parking place or even as a pedestrian, you know, you're walking with the lines that says you're a pedestrian, you have the right to cross the street, but somebody is kind of pushing you, you know, they're kind of revving their engine. Because they don't have the patience to wait for you cross the street in your own time frame. You know, so there's things that are thermometers for just how arousable we are, how quick we are to get something out of our, you know. And that kind of reactivity does diminish even in normal life. I mean, I witness it, and I'm not a spectacular saint or anything like that, but that does diminish because, you know, there's a certain physiology that people are discovering, and neurology, people are discovering the impact that practice has on our entire nervous system. You know, we have the vagus nerve. It's the largest nerve in our body. It travels down our spine. It connects at the base of the neck and goes all the way down to our tailbone. And they've discovered that the very first thing that is affected is that we are in touch with the condition of our nervous system. That's why there's a restlessness and an agitation when we first sit. And the practice begins to relax it. And the vagus nerve is like the main trunk. All the rest of the nervous system comes out of it all the way to our fingers and toes. So to put it in a non-spiritual perspective, we're relaxing our entire nervous system. The more we do it, the more relaxed we are. The less jarring things are to us. So it's an accumulated process of relaxation. When you think that this nerve connects right to the base of our brain, which is the famous reptilian part of our brain, which is all anxious about survival. So there is an accumulated positive effect that we can experience on a day-to-day level. I sometimes work in corporations, and people tell me just an email popping up freaks them out, you know. I notice, for example, if there's a fire engine or something coming down the highway, and you realize you're going to have to move over, and you need to scope out where, how far back it is, and what lane should be cleared so that there's a, I have much less anxiety about taking the time to figure it out and to do the right thing without getting all fussed up. Yeah. So there is an accumulating positive effect on the entire body. And we are a body. You know, we are a body. And even though we have an extraordinarily lovely life here in California, in the Bay Area, we're very cranked up and anxious. It's amazing. What time does this go to? 8:30, we are there. We are here. Let's just do 3 minutes of just sitting so that we can aspirationally leave the room more relaxed.